Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic for the hour this evening is health disparities in the Bay Area. Tell me your zip code and I'll tell you how long you're likely to live. Public health professionals have been saying different versions of this for decades, but a recent study focused on Alameda County has shown yet again the unmistakable link between life expectancy and wealth. Your educational level, income, and race all have more to do with your health than you might think. And it's not just about access to health care. Where we live, where we work, and where we play all seem to impact our longevity and well-being. In other words, your health has as much to do with your environment as it does with your genetics. Tonight, on the heels of the recent PBS documentary Unnatural Causes, we'll talk with public health professionals about new ways of understanding the determinants of health from a social policy level. And we'll take a closer look at the health disparities amongst the patchwork of communities that make up the Bay Area. Joining me tonight in the studio are Dr. Andy Beinman, Professor of Medicine, Health Policy, Epidemiology, and Biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco, and the Chief of the Division of General Internal Medicine at UCSF's affiliate San Francisco General Hospital. He's also the Director of the UCSF Division of General Internal Medicine's Research Fellowship Program, where he specializes in studying health disparities. We're also joined by Rochelle Poulon. She's the Director of Outreach for Unnatural Causes, a four-hour documentary series which aired this month on PBS, exploring socioeconomic and racial inequities in health. And finally, we're joined by Dr. Bob Prentice. He's Director of the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative, a collaboration of eight Bay Area counties' public health departments, which just released a report this month on health inequities in the Bay Area. He's also a senior associate with the Public Health Policy and Practice Division at the Public Health Institute, and Bob was previously director of the Public Health Division at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Thanks to all three of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll do so in about 20 minutes, and you can do so by calling 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, or by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, Rochelle Poulon, I wanted to start with you. Welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
So I was reading up a lot of the press material that was related to your ambitious project, actually, that was put together by folks here in San Francisco, if I'm correct. And a lot of striking statistics were quoted in there. And I thought to kind of ground our conversation, we'd start with that. Just give us a few of the salient points or the sort of the ahas about health disparities that really might give our listeners a quick and dirty introduction to this topic.
Well, I'll start off with healthcare, in the sense that most people tend to think of health as healthcare, as something that have to do with our personal behaviors or our genes. And that's not what the series really sought to address. So I'll start off by saying that in the United States, we spend twice as much per capita on healthcare, and yet we rank 30th when it comes to life expectancy. So that goes to show that there's something else that's affecting our health, and all our solutions don't lie in our access to healthcare. But really, we have to look at the social conditions in which we're born, in which we live, and in which we work.
Okay. And another one?
Another one. All right. We'll look at how African-American women with a higher socioeconomic status still have a greater chance of having a preterm birth than white women who haven't graduated from high school or than black women who have immigrated to the United States. So that really talks about the impact of racism over the life course, and that it's not just something people are, quote-unquote, making up, but that racism actually gets under the skin and affects our levels of chronic stress and our body's ability to deal with health and our ability when it comes to childbearing.
That's actually quite striking to me, because I'd imagine that if you gained a certain social and economic strata, that perhaps you could leave behind some of the stressors of your your trajectory in life.
And that's true. So when we compare African-American women to other African-American women and we look at the race of socioeconomic status, we see that African-American women with a higher socioeconomic status have better birth outcomes than African-American women with a lower socioeconomic status. But when we do that comparison across races and compare African-American women to Caucasian women, that's where we see that there's still an inequity. Mm. So that's to say that we can't just talk about class in America. We also have to talk about racism, which isn't something that a lot of people want to do, and link those two to our health outcomes.
Right. And that race is really not a proxy for other things except race, it sounds like, in the statistic you're quoting there.
Right. And we talk about racism, not so much race, because it's not the biology of race. It really is the impact of racism and discrimination in the life course.
That's a good point. I'm glad you clarified that. And Bob Prentice, to take it home to the Bay Area, your organization just put out a 40-some-odd page report on this topic specifically how it impacts the Bay Area. So why don't you run through some of the highlights of the study and of the results that you have?
I think what was most striking to me was that we documented that if people live in a neighborhood where there's a low percentage of poverty, compared to people who live in neighborhoods where there's a high percentage of poverty, there's on average about a decade's worth difference in life expectancy. I mean, that's huge.
That is.
And trying to unravel that, understanding all the things that go into that. Racism, as Rochelle mentioned, the distribution of income and wealth, but also the physical conditions in a neighborhood that contribute to poor health. You know, it's probably more familiar to people listening to say that when we did the analysis, we broke it down and looked at neighborhoods. And people who live in Bayview Hunters Point can expect to live on average 14 years less than people who live in Russian Hill.
That's amazing.
And it's not unique to Bayview Hunters Point. People live in West Oakland can expect to live over a decade less than people who live in the hills. Or in Contra Costa County, it's people who live in Bay Point can expect to live on average 11 years less than people who live in Orinda. So there is something about not just the place we live, but the conjuncture of where we live with poverty, with race, with immigration, that really are at the heart of what we think is the larger health policy discussion we have to have.
Mm-hmm. And are there certain counties in the Bay Area that just fare well, better on average in terms of health quotient than others? Or does each county have its own sort of hierarchy of health?
Each county has its own hierarchy. I think it's not a surprise to say that in the 9-county Bay Area, which was what we covered in the study, some counties on the whole are wealthier than other counties. But even in places like San Mateo or Marin County, where what we found may not show up given the level analysis we have, there are pockets of poverty. So it may not show in the kind of data that we present, but there are neighborhoods where many of the same conditions exist. So the issue isn't simply a few counties. The issue is every county. The other thing I should mention that does matter is that when we looked at life expectancy, it conforms to what's called a social gradient. That is, the more income and wealth people have, the longer their life expectancy. But it's not just rich and poor. So people who live in middle-income areas can expect to live longer than people who live in low-income neighborhoods, but not as long as people who live in more affluent neighborhoods. So it does affect everybody.
Okay. That would be, I guess, Andy, what they would call the dose-response curve.
Well, you can talk to the doctor now.
Welcome, Andy Beinman, to the program, and I need to disclose that I used to work for Andy when I was a resident at San Francisco General.
Those were the good old days for us, Joseph.
So welcome, Andy Beinman from UCSF and San Francisco General, to the program. But yeah, tell us a little bit more about this sort of the dose-response that we were just talking about, the social gradient.
Well, I think the things that you're talking about when we're talking about neighborhood and these kinds of relationships is we've got to start to picture what does that mean when we talk about neighborhood. What we're talking about is the characteristics of the neighborhood, such as what kind of food you can buy in that neighborhood, whether there are open spaces where one can exercise. What are some of the things about that physical environment that make it feel like a safe place where someone can practice the health behaviors that we know to be beneficial for you? I mean, one of the great frustrations that I have as a physician sometimes is to recommend to my patients that something that would be beneficial for the health would be to go out and exercise. And even when the patient buys into this, okay, I'm going to make a change in my life, doc, they have to acknowledge the barriers they face in being able to execute that plan, because are there places where they can go and feel safe to jog or to go to swim or to do the kinds of activities that we talk about? Or similarly, if I talk to them about how to adjust their diet to avoid obesity or to avoid complications of diabetes or other issues that may come up in their health, again, there may be real barriers in terms of access to stores that provide healthy choices in terms of being able to carry out that plan. I think it is multi-leveled, and I think we've got to think about deconstructing and understanding what neighborhood means. I think one aspect what was raised was about issues of racism, I think are very important. But I think there are a variety of factors in play. You've made a very important point that we're talking about health and not health care, but we should remember that these same neighborhoods face enormous challenges of getting health providers to work in those areas too. The example that Mr. Prentice just brought up in terms of talking about different neighborhoods, you know, it'd be the same problems in Bayview Hunter's Point of getting doctors compared to Russian Hill. The concentration of doctors practicing in Russian Hill is enormously higher than it is on a per capita basis in Bayview Hunter's Point. So there's multiple levels of challenges. And I think when you talk about dose response, it's, you know, how many of these different challenges you face in your neighborhood, and they add up or perhaps multiply one another in terms of the complexity of leading to health problems.
Right. So it sounds like, despite trying to motivate self-efficacy in your patients, that there's only so far that they can really go in terms of achieving the health goals that maybe you and they negotiated together because of these environmental constraints.
Absolutely. The environment has got to be thought about. And, you know, one of the things that I hope we'll have a chance to talk about more in the show is what are the mechanisms to both help educate doctors to engage and understand issues about environment so that they can be beneficial in working with patients to understand the constraints of the environment for the patient and to come up with practical plans to overcome some of those barriers. Look, we all recognize we need better social policies to improve these neighborhoods, but we also need ways of understanding how the healthcare system can interact in more constructive ways of working with understanding the issues of where a patient comes from so that we can effectively develop plans that will work for that patient.
Yeah, I definitely want to make sure we do spend some time in this program talking about solutions, because oftentimes we get mired in stating the problem and then we run out of time. So I would definitely want to make space for that. So going back to Rochelle, can you give us a picture of some of the stories that are portrayed in your documentary to give us a better sense of, like, what is it really, what is neighborhood, the sense of neighborhood that Dr. Beinman here was talking about? What does that really mean? And what are some of the things that people face day to day that are just constantly sort of pushing them back in terms of all sorts of ability to achieve certain goals in their lives?
Right, it's the wear and tear on the body, and it's cumulative. So what we try to do with unnatural causes is inequality making us sick is to combine both the research that's been done at the same time, really put that in the context of stories of people, real people, so that it's not a lot of experts saying this is what we see, but it's also let's meet the folks who are living this in day-to-day life. And so the series, Unnatural Causes, is organized into seven different episodes. And each of those episodes goes to a different place and looks and works with a different community as well. So one example that's close to home is the Place Matters show. And that one really goes and does a comparison in a sense of two neighborhoods, one in Richmond, California, and the other in Seattle, Washington. And looking at not just, oh, this neighborhood is disinvested, but looking historically at what caused this neighborhood to become this way. One of the things that we also need to talk about is that these neighborhoods, good, bad, and some in between, didn't just happen. Mm-hmm. There are actual social policies that were put in place that disinvest and take resources out of some places and bring other resources to other neighborhoods. So in the case of Richmond, there the story really looks at how Richmond became a boom town during the Second World War because it was a major place where ships were built. Now, after the war, where there are no needs for ships, what happened is that the jobs evaporated. So everyone who could leave did leave. At the same time, we see that the U.S. government starts providing federal housing loans, but those loans are provided on a racially restricted basis. So that means that a lot of black families and other families of color weren't able to access those loans. Now, it's, well, why? What does that matter? What we see in the United States is that our wealth, so not our income, what we make every month, but really our wealth, what we're worth, is mostly concentrated in our homes. So when you see a good part of the population being able to have, or a major part of the population being able to have access to homes, that means that for their families, they can borrow against that home to send children to college, to buy another home, and to start really building equity. And then what happens in communities of color, that same opportunity was not provided. So there we see what happens to Richmond is going from a place that provided opportunity for people to come to work and to live their lives and support their families with dignity to taking that away. And so now we have an area where it's very hard to find grocery stores, to have access to safe places, that we see both environmental pollutants, but at the same time, a disinvestment in the educational system. And education is supposed to be the place that really balances out, is our way to move out of poverty. So when we go to that show, the Place Matters show, we meet one family, Guai Bunka and his family, and hear about how he's been trying to stay and to thrive and to find a job and even tried to leave Richmond and then had to come back because he couldn't find a job in another place. And so that brings together, and his family is very much impacted by violence as well. So we see it's exactly that, this buildup of one incident after another, and he has a heart attack. And so we meet him 2 weeks after his heart attack in his doctor's office, and his doctor says, well, we asked for all the usual causes of heart attack, but we don't see that. It doesn't run in the family. He's very young. And so we have to look at the causes, the life in which he lives. And I can fix him up here, but I send him right back out to that community. And that's exactly this place, as Andy was saying, of trying to create those linkages so that we don't talk about health as just being healthcare. Mm-hmm. And we have a paradigm shift. So we look at place as one of the ways to come to health and then start to ask those questions. And that question can be, why? Why is this community this way? Why is this school this way? So we start to move up and look at the kinds of policies that can make a lasting change.
I just wanted to run through. I was just jotting down as you were speaking all the sort of the determinants here, right, of the outcome of the story. Jobs, racism, in this case with respect to access to home loans, therefore home ownership, and therefore the ability to build equity. Food choices. Physical safety, education, and violence. Mm-hmm. You know, and nowhere was smoking a cigarette or one of the, you know, the fact that maybe the person couch surfs, is a couch potato most of the time and watches TV. None of those were which is what we usually think of when someone has a heart attack. None of those things were relevant to this story, which I think is I imagine what the point that you're trying to make here.
Exactly. And it's looking at how we can be either socially connected or not socially connected and what happens there. So speaking of solutions, we also do see, and we go into that show and looking at what are some of the community organizing projects that are happening so that people can come together and have and start to work toward change. So it's not to say that Richmond doesn't have opportunities, but it is to say that that work is not about one individual. And while America is pull yourself up by the bootstraps, to make a change and to really create a more equitable society where we have that chance to make those right choices, we have to work together and we have to make changes at the policy level.
You know, it is about tobacco and other things that weren't mentioned. And I don't want to make light of that. I think one of the great accomplishments in public health in California in particular has been reduction in smoking rates. It's translated into in excess of a 20% reduction in lung cancer rates, and sort of probably Andy can speak more to the contributions to declining heart disease rates. But I think the point that Rochelle is making is that it's not as simple as telling people not to smoke. Mm. You need to step back and ask where people live. And if you're in a neighborhood where there is an abundance of stores that specialize in tobacco, alcohol, I mean, that's going to sound familiar to a lot of people, fast foods, that becomes your universe of choice. You make your decisions day to day there, especially if there are stores where, you know, there's not healthier options. So you're really looking at the construction of a whole neighborhood that contributes to things that might otherwise be thought of as sort of more in medical terms, the risk factors associated with diseases. So I think our purpose here is not to get into a debate about public health versus healthcare. I think the point here is trying to understand as fully as we can all the things in our day-to-day lives that contribute to people's illness that are otherwise preventable. And then to the extent that we're not successful, the importance of having regular access to doctors and hospitals.
Absolutely. Although I think there are some interesting points that were raised in Rochelle's story as well, which are that, you know, one of the things we haven't touched on here is the stress that is faced by people in everyday life in these environments. There's pretty good research emerging to demonstrate how that impacts the capacity of an individual's immune system. I mean, we certainly need to understand these things better, but there is stress, and I don't mean the stress that I feel after my day at work of I'm kind of tired and worn out, but it's that daily stress of feeling unsafe, of feeling uncertain about how you're going to eat that day, how you're going to take care of your very basic daily needs. And that stress does seem to have very dramatic impacts on the immune system, which makes people susceptible to different kinds of diseases, whether it's heart disease or a variety of other kinds of chronic conditions. And I think we need to understand this better. We're certainly doing research on that. But I don't think it can be discounted as a really important factor in all this in terms of people's health.
I'm glad you brought up the topic of research, because I think that, you know, if any of this is going to have momentum, that having the grounded scientific research is probably going to be what's going to shift policy over time. So is there research really literally on the molecular level to understand, the cellular level to understand the interactions on...
Well, I won't claim to be an expert in that particular area. However, I think there's a lot of good work going on at UCSF and elsewhere around the country that are looking at what we understand about the immune system. So yes, at the cellular level, and I'm sure below that as well, on how different kinds of stressful environments as well as social class and so forth affect different kinds of pathways that we know to be important in terms of controlling the immune system. So absolutely there's research going on that. I do think, though, that this brings up another issue, which is, you know, part of research is, as you say, to guide policy. It also, tends to drive one kind of model that we see over and over again in the medical system, which is when we can identify problems and figure out a pill that we can give for that, that's a certain kind of business model that has been very successful for certain kinds of industries. And I think one of the things we have to ask ourselves when you bring up the issue of solutions is, how do we make a good business case that this isn't a healthy thing for all of us to have communities be this unhealthy? How do we all benefit from making healthier communities in some ways? This isn't going to be something that's going to be directly helping pharma in this case. And so who is it going to help is, I think, an important question toward trying to move toward a solution. How does a city like San Francisco measure its benefits when it invests in communities that are having these greater mortality rates and so forth? I think it's an important issue for us to think about with regard to social policy.
Great, and I want our other guests to answer that question, but I also want to get the community involved in this conversation. So I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to City Visions here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing health disparities with our guests, Dr. Andy Beinman of UCSF, Rachel Poulon of Unnatural Causes, the PBS documentary on health disparities, and Dr. Bob Prentice of the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative. We invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments, and you may do so by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So, Bob Prentice, how do you respond to Dr. Beinman's comments about...
I'll let Andy talk about the research into molecular biology. That's not my strong suit. And I think it is important that work is going on. It's broadly called how the outside gets inside. You want to know how things like stress have actual physiological consequences. But I think there's a whole field of research that's just being explored that we also need to consider. I mean, think of what Rochelle said earlier on, that the United States spends more than twice per capita in healthcare than any other country, and we rank 30th in the world in life expectancy. How can you explain that? And I think, you know, one of the areas that you got to pursue, the United States also is one of the most unequal countries among the developed societies in the world. And that's not inevitable. That's happened over the last 30 years. We're now at a stage of inequality that we haven't had since the 1920s. We essentially repealed a whole period of social policy that tried to mitigate some of the consequences of the great inequalities. And I think there's certain levels of research that need to be explored as well. I mean, it may sound silly, but macroeconomic policy and life expectancy, I mean, those may not be the standards of clinical trials. But we need to explore those questions because they're the big questions. And I think our understanding of what constitutes research is going to have to adjust to be able to entertain those questions.
But my sense is, Andy, that the frustrations of practitioners such as you and myself in being able to counsel folks on good health behaviors can get overwhelming when you realize that at a certain point that those words, although they're well-intentioned, really don't go very far, especially if someone can't actualize it.
Yeah, no, it's a big problem, and it's increasingly a problem. We rely a lot, for example, on our primary care system to be the place where we deliver those sorts of messages to patients. And, you know, just picking out a little bit up on Bob's point, I've had occasion to be involved in some work looking, for example, at the amount of time available for these kinds of consultations with patients in primary care in different countries. And the U.S. healthcare system is sort of squeezing that time out at the same time that we're trying to sort of figure out how to become more effective in delivering preventive messages. You know, our CDC recommends that the average American needs about 40 to 45 minutes of counseling or to execute different kinds of preventive strategies with patients each year. And yet, the average amount of time that an American gets in primary care in the U.S. is about 30 minutes compared to many other countries in
that
Europe.
That seems luxurious
and
based on what I hear from other folks.
That's in a whole year.
Sorry. I thought you meant per visit. I'm like, no.
Sorry if I was unclear. So you don't even get enough time in a whole year to accomplish the most basic things. So to then, on top of that, try to tailor the messages like we're talking about, to think about how to come up with strategies to recommend and counsel patients in the context of some very complex environmental issues, you know, really is going to require an investment in both retooling our healthcare system to respond to that in some ways and to provide some kinds of supports and most importantly, of course, to focus on these neighborhoods to give them the resources that can enable patients to execute these plans. How do we get physical environments to change in some way? And it's an incredibly important challenge for us to take on.
Right.
And I would add to that, that's why it's not about just looking at the healthcare field, but saying who do we need to have at the table and looking at health in a much different way, so that it means that housing advocates need to be at the table, because affordable housing does impact our levels of chronic stress. And so, and I would like to make the differentiation, just to echo what Andy was saying, as far as the difference between stress, which we all feel, and chronic stress. And chronic stress being the kind of stress that we don't have the resources and the tools to deal with. And that's what wears down the body. So in the show, and Natural Causes, one of the things we look at is how the flight or fight response. So that's great on a short amount of time. And part of what happens is that there's increased levels of cortisol, so you can run faster, remember better, react better. But if that flight or fight response is on all the time and it never gets shut down day after day, year after year, it's that increased level of cortisol which wears down the immune system and makes the body, the person, more susceptible to a whole host of chronic disease. And that's where we see the health disparities. So, and going back to this first point of who needs to be at the table, that's where the conversation has to include urban planning folks. It has to include, like I said, affordable housing. We have to include education folks. We have to make sure that there are ways of ensuring living wage jobs. And so it's that place where the very nature of how we do our work, we usually do it in silos and people don't know what the others are doing. That very nature has to change. And that's what needs to take perseverance, persistence, And in that, I believe, lies a whole host of opportunities.
Right. Your point there on the stress, chronic stress level, reminds me of some research I heard recently at a conference on depression that's looking at chronic stress levels and how they're looking at people's chromosomes and how literally the chronic stress levels and the chronic stress hormones are really unraveling, like the ends of your shoelaces, unraveling your DNA and cutting down your life expectancy or cutting down or have a lot to do with your depression. I don't want to misquote that research, but it's sort of generally in that area, which I find quite fascinating that we can actually distill it down, not to be reductionist necessarily, but we can actually see it on the molecular level. And I think it sort of shatters not only the mind-body dualism here, but mind-body-society just sort of like interacting consistently and constantly. So you're listening to City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're discussing health disparities with our guest, Dr. Andrew Beinman of UCSF, Rachel Poulon, who's worked on a PBS documentary, Unnatural Causes, about health disparities in the United States, and Dr. Bob Prentice of the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative. 415-841-4134 if you want to join our conversation. Again, 415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com for emails. So I do want to actually get to one email, and this email is from Shane Snowden, and she says, could you ask your guests about health disparities in relation to lesbian, gay, and bisexual, and especially transgender people who make up a substantial percentage of the Bay Area population and are subject to significant stress and stigma. We are often effectively excluded from health research because we are not allowed to self-identify, and even when we are included, as in the California Health Interview Survey, little or no follow-up research is conducted to measure the disparities we face. I'm getting some shaken heads here.
I can take a stab at it.
Okay, great.
And that's something that is not addressed in the show, and there'll be a number of lines of power and access and isms that aren't addressed in the show. So, but I do think that it's incredibly important to talk about both the lack of research that happens in the LGBTQ community, and the lack of documentation, and the fact that the persistent discrimination and invisibility does create a lot of stress. That there we can look very much at, we often see higher rates of alcoholism and drug abuse, and we see that in a lot of different communities. And that's not to say about behavior, but that's to say, how do people start to take care or try and medicate? And so that's something where there needs to be more, I believe, there needs to be more visibility, more research, and more done to talk about and to raise issues of discrimination and to raise issues and ways of having inclusion when we talk about the LGBT community. And to see how, and I know as far as discrimination and access to health care, that there's a lot more that needs to be done there. So it's not a full and complete answer, but it is to say that I'm glad that Shane brought this to the table, because it is something where I look for more and more research, and it's not as easily found.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that sort of Shane's comment highlights. So the question here, in the terms of each of your response to that question, although I don't think any of you would say that that wasn't an appropriate sort of an appropriate area of investigation. It's just, it's not something that's been invested in. Yes, Bob.
I think maybe there's one theme that she brought up that isn't common with what we're talking about. Earlier on, you said we don't want to just talk about the problem. I think the intent of doing this is to help people understand what it is they can do to organize, to be more effective, and who they need to be thinking about organizing with. And I'll just say, in my brief period, my long period at the San Francisco Health Department, there was a time when the issues about transgender health care became hugely important. And I saw the advantage of having the transgender community, particularly in the Tenderloin, become actively involved in the creation of a transgender clinic where people felt absolutely at home. And you just see, it is the health care on the one hand, but it is that sense of affirming community and all that's good, and it comes out through organizing, because you're helping to take control over not only your own life, but the circumstances that surround your life. And I think that's maybe a general principle that we're trying to arrive at here.
Okay, go ahead.
And just one last piece on that also, in talking about discrimination when it comes to jobs, especially for trans folks, and that's huge, because if people don't quote unquote pass, how much harder it is to be able to find a job and to have access to a living wage.
Okay, and I want to actually keep with this how to engage the stakeholders and who those should be as we move forward in our conversation. But I want to get our one of our callers on the line. Again, put out the number 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 if you'd like to join our conversation, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And we have Tatsu from San Francisco. Welcome to City Visions.
Oh, thank you very much. Fantastic show that you're doing. I had a question actually about epigenome. I had watched a show on PBS where they talked about the ways in which chronic stress and things that you do to your own health can actually affect the health of your children and your children's children. And so I was wondering if the panelists could just comment a bit about how stress and chronic stress and poverty and all of that can carry on and have effects for many, many generations, particularly within the Black community, because so much has happened to us from the legacy of slavery to Jim Crow and what have you. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks so much, Tatsu, for your call.
Thank you.
Well, it's a great question, and I think, again, another area where I wish I could say for certain that we had kind of research that would give us the direct answer to your question. I will say, though, that you're right on target in that we do know that, just to take an example of environmental exposures, which is partly tied to the neighborhoods that we're talking about, that it does seem quite likely that environmental exposures, for example, at the time that a woman is pregnant, could have important impacts on the fetus, and not only in terms of the fetus and their health, but also the development of either eggs or sperm of that fetus that can subsequently affect multiple generations. And so it's absolutely the correct kind of question, that the complexity of how different kinds of neighborhood exposures, and that could be in the form of stress, as was at the heart of your question, but could be in environmental exposures. I think there's also, part of how this plays out over generations that we have to learn how to separate with our research is to what extent is it not giving mobility to people to move out of their social class, as was brought up by Rachel earlier. Like, if we don't give access to education, then people are exposed to the same kinds of environments over the time. So I think there are real reasons to suspect that there are physical ways, anatomical, genetic ways that some of these things could play out. But it's also the case that we have many people who are exposed to the same kinds of environments over multiple generations. So I don't know that we've completely been able to separate and determine the answer to your question, but it's the right kind of question to be asking.
One of the studies that was in A Natural Causes was done by Sheldon Cohen, and what he did was to look at the link between home ownership. So the study was, if your parents owned a home when you were younger and these people were exposed to the cold virus, were people more likely to get a cold or less likely to get a cold? And the results found that home ownership, so people whose parents owned their home when they were younger, those people were less likely to contract a cold once they were exposed to the cold virus. And so while being exposed to the cold virus and getting cold isn't the measurement of everything, it does start to give a proxy for how our health and how the wealth of our parents affects our own ability to resist or our own susceptibility.
And I'd have to add, public health looks at the health of populations, which is different than looking at individuals. And we always have to learn how to go back and forth and understand the relationship. But the question, I think, points to something that is really quite striking, that if you look over the course of several generations, the populations that have by and large the worst health in overall are Native Americans and African Americans, who have also had the worst experiences living in this country. And so there are those questions about how the outside gets inside. Is it the repetition of similar experiences over generations, or is there actually something that goes on that is more than just an individual's exposure in the course of their lifetime, but it's this constellation of things that are social and physical and physiological that in fact may lead to extreme differences in things like life expectancy and health status overall.
It reminds me of a comment that I heard Dr. Anthony Eitan. He's a public health official in Alameda County.
Correct? He's public health director and health officer.
There you go. And I think collaborator with your organization.
He's a collaborator, yep.
And it's something I heard him say recently, that stress is communicable. And I just thought that was such a really interesting and frame-shifting comment for me. And it sort of speaks to, I think, the caller's question and some of your follow-up comments to that. 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you want to join our conversation tonight here on City Visions around health disparities in the Bay Area and nationally. And we're joined by Dr. Andrew Beinman, professor of medicine, health policy, and epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco, and chief of the Division of General Internal Medicine at UCSF's affiliate, San Francisco General Hospital. He's also the director of the UCSF Division of General Internal Medicine's Research Fellowship Program. And we also have Rochelle Poulon, director of outreach for Unnatural Causes, a four-hour documentary series which aired this month. And is still airing, or is it over?
In some select places, it's still airing, but
check
it is available
listings.
On DVD. So you can use it and foster conversation.
Okay, great. And I think there's a lot of teaching tools, right?
Mm-hmm.
And modules on the website,
yes.
Which we'll talk about towards the end of the program. Exploring socioeconomic and racial inequities in health, and Dr. Bob Prentice, director of the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative, a collaboration of 8 Bay Area counties, public health departments, which just released a report on this topic, specifically with respect to the Bay Area, and also associate with the public health policy and practice at the Public Health Institute, and previously even was director of public health division at the San Francisco Health Department. So again, 415-841-4134 to speak to the folks who are or have their minds occupied day to day around public health issues and health matters that matter to you. 415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So in the last 20 minutes or so of the program, we're definitely going to get to solutions. But let's take Richard from San Francisco on the line first. Richard, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. In terms of you were talking about the aid with the health disparities between, say, the people in the flatlands versus the people up on the hills, that kind of thing. I was wondering if you had a sub-breakdown in terms of, like, higher-income people in the flatlands or low-income people in the richer areas. Is there any kind of correlation in that area, or do you have any kind of sub-breakdown in that realm?
So this is
along those lines?
Right, this is a question for Bob Prentice, probably.
We didn't do that kind of a breakdown. It was more generally looking at the population in West Oakland versus people in the hills. I don't have a good answer for you. I think in general, though, that people with higher income are more likely to live longer. And if you're living in a neighborhood like West Oakland and you have a high income, I'm not sure how that affects your personal life chances. But it does go back to the point I was trying to make earlier. I know this sounds a little pointy-headed, but when you're looking at the health of whole populations, it doesn't translate easily into what is likely to happen for one person. You're really talking about sort of odds spread over a large portion of a population. So I'd be reluctant to speculate on that without having really sorted it out.
Okay. Does that answer your question as best we can?
It doesn't answer it. I'm really sorry. I wish I could give you a good answer. Yeah.
Thanks for your call. Okay. So let's get to the solution. So the question I wanted to kick start that part of the program is how are we going to get people to care about this topic beyond our conversation tonight? Not only the people who are the victims, I would say, of the health disparities, but all those around them. So let's start with the people who are mostly impacted. So we're talking about low-income people, mostly people of color, immigrants, although immigrants probably after they spent some time in this country, because there's some data that shows that immigrants' health status is actually better at the time that they enter the country than once they're here for several years. So how do we get that community, or those communities, mobilized to really say, wait a minute, this shouldn't be happening to us, and feel a sense of connection and agency?
I have a hesitation with with splitting it up community by community. So I want to...
Oh, okay. If you want to lump it, that's fine.
Well, I want to step back to, and go back to what Bob said earlier on, that there is this gradient to health. So it's not just the rich and the poor, but it's really all of us. We're all impacted, and we're somewhere on that gradient. And again, it's very true that this gradient is measured by population, so it's not just individuals. But it's to say that except for the very rich... the very, very, very rich, the rest of us are impacted because as a nation, we're not living as long as we could be living. So where we find ourselves then on that gradient does have a different translation into our health, but that there are going to be people above us who are living longer and healthier lives on average than we are, and there are going to be people below us who are living shorter and sicker lives than we are. But we're on that gradient. We're not somewhere on the outside of it. And so I think that part of this idea of the motivation is for everyone to see themselves as part of that picture. And then from there, it's about being able to find the ways that we can start to advocate from the local level to the state level to the national level for different policies. And so that can come in a lot of different forms, from first doing education, and that's where we hope the series will really be a tool for folks to do education and to raise this awareness, because not everybody knows that health is more than healthcare, or knows what are the root causes of health inequities, or that we can do something about it. So there needs to be education, and then there needs to be mobilization. So how do we come together? And that mobilization can be with those that we know already, that we're used to working with, but then how do we move and start to work across sectors with one another? How do we start to say, you know, what you're doing over here around jobs and labor, oh, health advocates can come on board and support that work. So an example would be in San Francisco having passed the ordinance that mandates for paid sick leave is huge. And that is a health policy. A lot of folks might say, you know, oh, it's sick leave. Yes, of course. Of course, it's a health policy. But that's to say that now people can be sick and take that time off. And there was fear that it was going to be abused. But now a year later, we're hearing a lot of businesses and restaurants saying, you know, actually, people aren't abusing it. So those are the kinds of policies we can work towards. And it's this combination of doing the education, doing the mobilizing, and then advocating that brings us all together, so that we're not trying to move out of my neighborhood to go to that neighborhood, but it's what are the assets in my neighborhood and how do I capitalize on those to start to make change?
But I guess my question is, how do we get people who are on the higher rungs of that gradient to care about the people on the lower rungs? Is there any evidence to, and maybe we don't need evidence, but usually it helps, is there any evidence to say that the health of the people who are less well off than us impacts the health of someone who is in a higher economic status? The question is the proximity of the problem. How close is it to your actual day-to-day existence? So Bob or Andy?
Well, I think the way that manifests in part is less about thinking about these diseases as spreading in the old-fashioned way that we think about infectious diseases, and to think about the other ways that these things come back and do affect us all. For example, ultimately, if we have a sicker part of the population that needs to rely on our public delivery system, we all end up contributing toward paying toward a more expensive end of healthcare delivery. So rather than potentially investing in the front end of preventive care to keep people healthy, to keep a healthy workforce available to us, we end up spending a lot of our tax dollars on the high cost end of healthcare. So that'd be one example. And, you know, it's also very clear when we don't give people opportunities, that's when we see crime rates go up and other kinds of manifestations of social disruption that do affect us all. So I would think of it less as spreading in terms of health consequences directly, and more in other ways that we are prevented from doing other beneficial things as a community, because we end up having to spend dollars on cleaning up the consequences of our poor social policy. And I do want to pick up on that issue, because I think one of the most interesting solutions that I've seen out there are some of the strategies that, for example, are going on in the United Kingdom, where a lot of this work that we're talking about here today about looking at how class affects health goes back to reports that were done in the United Kingdom, something called the Black Report, that talked about these important relationships of social class with health. But the United Kingdom did something that we have yet to really do in the same way here in the U.S. that I would love to see us do, which is to then take on the issue of how do we think about health from the point of view of social policy and not compartmentalize it into things like health departments have to come up with a solution. And I think you set up this program very nicely today by trying to bring out some distinction between health and healthcare. Healthcare is an important part of the solution, but it's no way it can do it by itself. And I think we need to move toward thinking about every social policy. Let's just take the city and county of San Francisco. Every time there's a debate about what we're going to do about transportation or what we're going to do about education or any part of our social policy, we need to think about what the health consequences are and to make our decisions in part related to that. And I think that would, in fact, move us a long way. So let's not just think about where is it convenient to put a bus, but to think about what the implications of having a bus to connect to, getting to public places where people could exercise or things like that. So, you know, similarly, as we think about where to put bike lanes in the city, let's connect them up to all the schools around the city so kids can ride their bikes to school and things like that. So I just think that there's an important opportunity not to segment and to put health into one department. The health department has an enormous job. Mm-hmm. They have an enormous leadership role to play. But if we rely on the health department to solve this, we will be in the same problem that we're in now. We really need to expand thinking about the health consequences of all of our social policies.
So, Bob Prentice, are we talking about reaching, having other people pick up the slack where the health department has been sort of leading the charge but no one else has been responding? Or are we talking about public health redefining itself and what it sees as its mission and how it achieves its goals?
If that's a choice, I like the second one best.
Okay.
I want to start there with the question you asked the last time. I certainly agree that we're trying to build a broad base of support, but I represent a group of 8 health departments that are doing exactly what you said. If you look at the health of populations, you can't just accept that one neighborhood has a life expectancy 14 years less than another. It's not all the same. So if we're going to be anywhere, if we're going to set down stakes, it's going to be in those neighborhoods. And also, it's not just a question of us mobilizing people. I think those neighborhoods are mobilized a lot already. I mean, look at what folks in Baby Hunters Point did. It took maybe a decade, but they got the power plant shut down. There's battles over the cleaning of the shipyard. And now what Andy was saying, the whole issue about redevelopment, under what terms will redevelopment occur? Will it be done in a way that makes life better for people who are living there, or will they experience it as a wedge of gentrification? So these are the issues that's what I said earlier, the day-to-day living conditions that affect people's health. This is the new territory for public health. And I think the health departments in the Bay Area are, first of all, trying to figure out how to work better with people in those neighborhoods where the improvement is so much even the importance of improving those neighborhoods is so much greater than other places. But it means figuring out now how to work with planning departments and transportation agencies and the various groups that are doing economic development. Redevelopment itself has a tough history in this city. And on the other hand, it has a lot of potential. How do you reestablish the potential so that the people who live in the neighborhood see that? And so this is taking us very far from what has been largely the clinical training of people in health departments. It means it's understanding community organizing. It's understanding land use planning. It is very new territory, largely virgin to health departments. But that's where we think we need to go, and that's where we think the direction of public health in the 21st century is.
So another question along these lines is the state of affairs currently because public health departments have sort of isolated themselves over the years, or is it because no one else has really understood the connection or made the case to them how all the environmental impacts and the sort of interaction between environment and health and social policy and economics, et cetera, et cetera?
You know, I wouldn't lay this just on public health departments. I mean, you know, part of this discussion about, you know, the percentage of the population uninsured and how much we spend is part of a much larger web of public policy, which really started, you can say, 78, the Prop 13, the assault on the public sector. I mean, people have understood a lot of what we're talking about now, but you know, your year after year of budget cuts, you can't grow. You spend most of your time trying to defend what you've got. So, I think what you've got is a new resolve. People are saying that there's always a budget climate. You know, that can't be an excuse. We've got to figure out how to do this anyway. But it's going to take a lot of support not just from the health department, but from the other agencies and public officials who are willing to say that health is more than just what we do in the clinic, and they're willing to direct a lot of those other public agencies whose decisions have a lot to do with health to work with health departments and communities.
And Rochelle, are there any examples in your documentary around the people really coming together, different stakeholders, both community, politicians, policymakers, wonks, and other sorts of technocrats, to actually do what Bob is envisioning?
There are some examples, and some of those actually even in the Place Matters show, where we go to Seattle, Washington, and look at how a community was rebuilt through this kind of working across sectors. And it doesn't mean that it was perfect, but it does show how a community could rebuild housing, rebuild itself, create a neighborhood that had much more opportunity for social inclusion, that included a market, walkable, safe spaces where people get to know each other, as well as a community clinic. So that's one example, but also I'd like to say that for the series and Natural Causes, one of the things that we have found to be really amazing is the number of organizations, from national organizations to community-based organizations, who have joined on and become partners in this campaign to really use the series as a tool to foster this kind of conversation, to have a paradigm shift in how we talk about health, and to start coming together across sectors. So there's a lot happening across the country, and while the series, it's a tool, it's not going to fix everything in and of itself, but it is a tool that people can use to educate, to organize, and to advocate for change, along with the website at naturalcauses.org, where there's a lot of the research that we're talking about, as well as ways, a connect-up database to connect one another together. So find out who's working in your area around what issues to start making those links across sectors.
Okay, and Andy Byman, we're going to start wrapping up the program, but you mentioned education and made me think of your first comment, which is this, how, what are the impacts, or what should be the impacts on medical education of these types of findings, of this revolution in what it means to be a public health practitioner?
Yeah, I do think that's an important part of it, is to get a workforce that's able to speak the vocabulary of public health. Too long in this country, we've had a divide between sort of the medical training and the public health training. I think UCSF is doing a wonderful job of trying to push those barriers. We're seeing a lot of excitement and interest on the part of our students for this kind of training. And I think it is going to challenge us as educators of how we do it. Some of the things we've talked about that I think would be very exciting, for example, would be to assign each medical student sort of a street to get to know during their time in medical school, and to learn about the health of the people on that street over time, and to sort of understand the context for health problems, not just what happens in the hospital, but what happens in the community. And I think, although we don't have sort of something to just break out of the box and say we have it right, but I think your question is right on, which is we need to extend the expertise of the clinician so that it understands clinical work in that public context.
And Bob Prentice, how does the community get more involved if they want to really take this issue on? Are there what's the website they can read your report on? And are there any sort of public comments or periods or other ways in which people can get involved in really keeping this dialogue going?
Well, the website is www.barhi.org to get the report. I think the real issue that for people in the communities, I think in a lot of those communities there already is a relationship with the health department. Push it. I think there's a great interest on the part of the health department in deepening those relationships. And I think with Barhi, we want to see if we can build a regional network so that communities are more effective. There's a group called Ditching Dirty Diesel Collaborative that has done some remarkable work on diesel, because they've figured out how not to just work as separate communities but join together. And that's an image of where I'd love to see us go in the Bay Area.
Okay. And Rochelle Poulon, give us that website one more time, and then one sort of note of hope from all the stories you've told us to take us out of the show tonight.
I'd say unnaturalcauses.org, and we've seen social policies that have done this in the past, and so we can do it again.
So we shouldn't stress too much?
We shouldn't stress too much, but it's really about... There's a movement happening right now. There's a lot of energy, there's a lot of work, and there's a lot of innovative ways to come to this. So no one has to do everything, but it's about understanding that we all work under this larger umbrella of health, whether we're housing advocates, mm-hmm. community members, educators, physicians, wherever we come from, we're impacted by this, and we can come together and make a difference. We're seeing that happening.
All right, and that's City Visions for tonight. Our guests this evening were Dr. Andy Beinman of UCSF, Rachel Poulon, Outreach Coordinator for Unnatural Causes, the PBS documentary that explores racial and socioeconomic inequities in health, and Dr. Bob Prentice, Director of the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative, a collaboration of eight Bay Area counties' public health departments. And I want to thank all three of you for a very enlightening conversation this evening.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
All right. And for a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to sign up for alerts and download podcasts, check out our website. That's at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Thanks so much, Debbie. Tonight's producer was the wonderful Susie Oki. City Vision's executive producer is Rose Levinson. Morgan Humes is the senior producer. Our associate producers are Daphne Humes and Brian Moran. Join my co-host Lauren Meltzer next Monday when our topic will be a Q&A with Sierra Magazine's Hey Mr. Green. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great week.